you like listening to those ads, or would you rather hear an ad-free version of The Gist? Well, it's your lucky day, because in the lab, we've developed such an animal. It's like the vegan meat of podcasting. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to become an ad-free subscriber, or choose from other tiers with additional bonus content. And they all taste like chicken. Enjoy the show. It's Friday, January 17th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. TikTok has been banned. Clear free speech implications. A media company, which TikTok was, shut down by fiat, by government fiat. Other media companies, actual news companies in some cases, seem intent on hobbling themselves unilaterally, though the specter of the government looms in many of these cases. We know about Fox and the Dominion settlement. Today, a Florida jury found that CNN defamed a U.S. Navy veteran in 2021, a story about paying people to rescue endangered Afghans following the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Zachary Young said his business was destroyed because CNN showed his face on screen in a story about the black market of smuggling out desperate Afghan citizens. And he won that suit, somewhat unusually. Even more unusually is that recently ABC settled a suit that every legal expert said it would have won, settled a suit with Donald Trump at issue. Should George Stephanopoulos had said sexual assault instead of rape, wasn't perfectly clear. Again, because of the high barrier to losing a libel suit due to the nature of Donald Trump as a clear public figure, you can't find a legal analyst who would say that CBS would have lost. Still, CBS paid up. Why? Because, of course, CBS is owned by Disney, and Disney has other business in front of the Trump administration. And that is going on, or seems to be going on, the Wall Street Journal reports, with another suit, this one even more risible than the ABC suit. You might remember, in the waning days of the campaign, 60 Minutes did a report on Kamala Harris. At one point, in a preview of the 60 Minutes report, the show Face the Nation aired a clip of a Kamala Harris answer to a question. But then during the 60 Minutes report, they edited it differently so that Kamala Harris gave a different answer, a more complete answer, but also a different answer to that question. This is all fairly standard practice, or should be fairly standard practice, for news organizations, but Donald Trump didn't like it, and he sued for $10 billion. Today, the Wall Street Journal reports that Paramount, owner of CBS, its namesake studio, and several cable channels, has a major piece of business in front of the new administration, its planned merger with Skydance Media. It's become clear to executives at both companies that Trump's dissatisfaction with CBS News will make the review tougher than they anticipated, and that they'll likely need to offer concessions to win approval. And yes, among those concessions, settling on the lawsuit that Donald Trump filed for $10 billion against CBS because he didn't like how they edited an interview with someone who wasn't Donald Trump. We're not sure if this is the sort of thing that the Wall Street Journal got a hold of because someone in those negotiations wanted to pre-leak the consideration to shame the executives out of doing that. But that is at least a consideration, and it is at least another moment of inglory for a press that says it's under assault and seems to be, but seems to be also confronting that assault with immediate capitulation. On the show today, the Palisades and Eaton fires in Los Angeles do continue to burn, though they are more contained. The winds have weakened, though, of course, they could pick up again. The National Weather Service says dangerous conditions are expected next week. And today, in a full show interview, we ask questions like the questions they're asking in California. How quickly can they rebuild? And in fact, the answer to that question might be that is the wrong question to ask. My next guest says we should ask how can we rebuild in a way which would help prevent this from happening again. I'll be joined by Claire Frank, A 30-year veteran of the California Fire Service. She was the fire chief of Milpitas, California, which is up near Sacramento. She is the author of Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. And Claire Frank is up next. Claire Frank is the author of Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. She served in the fire service for 30 years, was fire chief of a fire department in California near San Jose, and then went on to Cal Fire, where she was chief of fire protection. She's going to talk about the fires that have beset Los Angeles and what it's like to fight fires of that nature, if they can actually be fought. Claire Frank, welcome to The Gist.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
So I read something that you wrote, and you said you've battled 70-mile-per-hour winds, which I can't quite fathom, but never 100. Give me a sense, and then we'll have to multiply by almost 50%. What is it like to fight a fire in 70-mile-per-hour winds?
Yeah, it's a blowtorch. You can't get in front of the fire. So you're fighting from behind the fire. You have some flanking capabilities sometimes, but you can't catch the fire. So we use different tools. Instead of doing direct attack, we try to put the fire in a box. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Palisades, the one end of the box at the head of the fire was the coast, right? So it was going to burn to that. There was nothing, right. There was no other place to put a perimeter line in those kinds of winds.
Is best practice to fight the fire from the front to stop it in its path?
Sure. If you've got a small fire, you want to go direct attack. It's what everyone thinks firefighters do in wildland fires. It's get the hose out, spray the water right on the flame, and you work your way around the fire, and then you cut a line around it, and it's out. But when they get this big and this complex, people have heard of like backfires where you create a perimeter line, or yep. You get a rock outcropping, or you find a highway and you set fire to run into the fire. So the fires put each other out. But in these kinds of winds, you can't set a fire. it's going to just go the same direction. So it's a different kind of beast in 70-mile-hour winds. And these are hot, dry winds. These are Santa Ana devil winds, right? These aren't cool coastal winds. They don't have any moisture in them. So it's a beast. It's just a beast.
And one of the tools to fight a huge fire is aerial, but above how many miles per hour can't helicopters or airplanes operate?
Yeah, so it depends on who operates the helicopters. I think I heard in LA County they ground them at 40 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably needs to be fact checked, but
yeah,
it also depends on how, you know, if you're talking about kind of tornado twisting winds, or if you're talking about just one direction winds, but 70 miles an hour, you're not going to have effective aerial operations, which is the other way we build the box, right? We do these great retardant drops and then we send in ground resources, but the retardant drops, you know, you can't hit a ridgetop when it's blowing at 100 miles an hour.
Right. Even if you could get the planes up, it would, you know, your retardant would go everywhere. So it's this exponential thing.
Yeah.
Once the most dangerous conditions arise, the greatest or some of the greatest tools that you have are not available
right.
to you. And it just gets, like I said, exponentially more dangerous.
Correct.
It's almost not even firefighting at that point as you usually practice it.
Right. I mean, you gotta build the corral. And the corral has to be built at a rate that travels faster than the fire, right? So you're mobilizing all of these resources to try to figure out where you're gonna try to stop the fire. Where are the perimeters gonna go?
Right. Now, I have read that the warnings, the extreme warnings, there are a few criteria that have to be met. The winds, the hurricane force winds, humidity less than 10 or 15%, but also temperatures over 70 degrees. And I was looking at the temperatures when some of these fires started, and they did go above 70 degrees. And I also read it was the only time in January that they know of, in the history of January, that those conditions all applied. Is that your understanding as well?
That is my understanding. I mean, we've seen these kinds of fires. We usually see them in late fall. October, the Camp Fire, which was in Northern California, that happened in November. But January, I mean,
right.
Yeah, this is historic in that sense. It felt like, you know, it still feels, today I was outdoors playing pickleball instead of shoveling snow. It's great for temperate weather, but it's something we pay for. And, you know, on the other hand, we're not getting a snowpack. So,
and also the aspect of it being January is it just cold and uncomfortable, but you tell me, more dangerous for the firefighters when it's that cold, even if you're next to a roaring fire?
It's so uncomfortable. It's so uncomfortable. And I guess the danger doesn't really come from the cold. That makes it uncomfortable. But what the danger comes from is that these fuels have been baking month after month after month. So every month that they don't get moisture, they're dry.
The fuels are the vegetation,
right.
The dead
right.
leaves.
So it becomes more explosive. So in that respect, the fire behavior gets more explosive. The flames move quicker. That's without wind, you know, and you add wind to it and it's, you get what we got.
Yeah. And the other part of it being January is supposed to be the wet season
right.
in LA, or at least the wet-ish season. So when you're talking about the campfire being in November, there's not supposed to be, have been rain then. By now, you know, if things are going as nature intended them to go, there would have been some moisture on the ground, which would have a number of effects, including making that vegetation something less than the pure kindling that it is, right?
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of it, you know, this particular perfect storm, if you will, came from, we had a couple of years that had really good precipitation. And so what happens on those years is your lighter fuels come up. You know, you get a lot more grass and all of those fuels now are available to burn. So if we hadn't had the rain before, we wouldn't have as much fuel load. Kind of in some respects, Mother Nature knows exactly what she's doing on these things to create these perfect storm disasters.
Well, I did want to ask you about that. You know, there is, I've done reading, as I guess a lot of us have done. I even listened to a podcast called The Big Burn, where I first heard you interviewed. And a main thesis there was that for millennia, but as far as we know, as long as people were living there, indigenous people, there was fires, but there were controlled burns and fires were allowed to burn. And of course, there wasn't this built up man-made environment that allowed for such burning. How much would more burning, more controlled burns, how far would that have gone to prevent these fires?
Okay, so from a really macro level, we live in this Mediterranean climate. Fire was here before us. So fire is going to consume this area. And it's kind of interesting because we don't do it with other disasters. Like we don't try to stop a flood. I mean, we direct the flow, but there's no flood suppression. Like there is fire suppression. So we were actively engaged in doing something that the land wants to do. So prescribed fire, setting intentional beneficial fire to the land under prescribed conditions. That's where the word prescribed comes from. It's really like a medical prescription under, you know, with certain, all the elements that you mentioned, like what's the relative humidity? Is it within bounds? What are the winds? Is it within bounds? So that prescribed fire is, of course, good for the land. And of course, you know, the more low level, low intensity fires you have, the fewer high intensity fires you have when they're unintentionally started. But then now you add, you know, people living in these areas that want to burn. And that creates a whole different level of complexity, right? Because we don't want human lives at stake and we don't want houses destroyed. So we've kind of painted ourselves in a corner a little bit as humans who want to live in these fabulous areas. And we have to decide whether it's worth it, you know? year after year.
Right. So I guess what I'm thinking is, if we have, there are many different elements that cause it. There are the natural elements and there are the decisions that we've made. One is how to build, where to build. But I have also been hearing a lot about, we're just not wise. We attack fire as if it's always a problem. The wisdom of the ancients would dictate that some amount of fire is necessary. I also hear things like states don't want to do it because it counts against their carbon allotments. Fine. I'm wondering, first of all, you're right, a prescribed fire, just listen to the words. It is a prescribed fire. It, by definition, it's almost circular reasoning to ask if a prescribed fire is good. My question is more, if we have all the other conditions that are bad or that are, that work against fire safety, how much would even the greatest program of prescribed burns have made a difference?
Are you talking about how much they would have made a difference specifically to like the Eaton fire and the Palisades fire?
Yeah, let's talk about these recent fires. Let's say that the people who say prescribed burns are the way to go, they got their wish. There wasn't all this bureaucracy. There was many, many more prescribed burns because we understand it. Would we have averted the Eaton fire?
Yeah, so I think it probably would have been more helpful with the Eaton fire. The issue here with these fires... So there's the basic, let's go basic, fire triangle. You need heat, fuel, and oxygen. When you have drought-ridden lands or not enough precipitation in the wildland, you automatically have your fuel and you automatically have your oxygen. So the thing that you're missing is the heat source. And that's not air temperature. It's an ignition. It has to be something that burns much hotter than that, right? So an ignition source. And like you said, that's either lightning or some sort of human activity. Mm-hmm. What could have helped these fires is to not have that ignition source. That's really what it comes down to, because once you have these winds...
Is that feasible? Like, can you be 100% sure? Can you be spark-free in a huge landscape like the LA area?
No. So I'm not... No, I don't think you can, not with how human beings live. But the astonishing statistic for me is that 80% of all wildland fires in the United States, roughly, are unintentionally caused, right? It's just a mistake. Nobody meant to do it. So let's say we cut that in half. Or something, don't even talk about zero, because I think that that's la-la land. But can we cut it in half? Can we cut it
in half?
You know, can we get it down to
25%? Then we'd have maybe half these fires. I get it. Yeah. Right. This is called progress, right?
Yeah.
Progress doesn't mean you totally take away all negative stimulus, but you just do better.
Right.
And is there no program for that? Or are people, I don't know, kids on a hike or a transponder exploding or an unhoused person trying to get warm. I mean, are they pretty much allowed to do that? I have also read there are dozens of arson prosecutions a day in Southern California. Are you saying that that is not a robust enough system of surveillance and enforcement?
I am. Mm-hmm. So about 10% of the wildfires are arson, and the other of fires that humans cause, the other 80% are unintentional. So the arson isn't, I mean, they're making a big deal about catching people during this time of chaos, and people who thrive on chaos are going to do stupid stuff. And so I'm not talking about the criminal element, but certainly the warming fires are a problem, but there's all kinds of, there's utility caused fires, there's kids playing with matches, there's trailer chains dragging on pavement, creating sparks. There's all kinds of things that are super preventable if you give it just a little bit more thought. And I worked for a program in CAL FIRE called the Civil Cost Recovery Program, where we took on cases where we could prove negligence. So it's not just talking about the arson. It's like, okay, did you do something that the reasonable person shouldn't have done or wouldn't have done? And we went after to get cost recovery for the cost of suppressing the fire. And there's a deterrent effect to that when you go after people's, wallets. And there's not enough of that kind of harshness. We've got Smokey Bear.
So what, just remind me, go back, what jurisdiction did you do that with?
That was Cal Fire.
Okay. And yeah. So that wouldn't apply to Los Angeles as well? That's not statewide?
So no, there's a statewide statute that allows.
Yes, but if you don't enforce the statute. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And you have to staff it. You have to, you know, ramp up a program and staff it. And, you know, it's another cost for municipalities. So,
right.
You know, prevention is usually the stepchild.
One of the issues that the governor, the city council says that they're going to look at is the question of why fire hydrants ran dry, especially in higher elevations. And from what I understand, there's 1 million gallons of storage available to these hydrants, and eventually they're going to run dry. This is just physics. They can't run forever. But there was also a 117 million gallon reservoir offline, scheduled maintenance, but the maintenance seems to have lasted a year. And why was it scheduled for this during the fire season? What can you tell us about, way into the extent you want to, but I actually have more of a technical question. The reservoir is, I think, literally upstream from the hydrants, right? So the reservoir being offline, how much would that affect the ability of those firefighters in that particular situation to get as much water as they could possibly get from those hydrants?
So, yeah, I mean, more water, better, right?
Yes, right.
But I think part of the problem was the simultaneous demand on the system, and it was a pressure drop. So if you can't, you know, hydrants rely on, you have to have a certain flow to flow all the hoses. And there were so many structures involved, and that's a high flow. So I don't know. I can't say. I think the after action report will do a deep dive into this and answer the question certainly more fully than I can. And we'll be able to say specifically whether or not it impacted the firefight. But I'm going to go back to the blowtorch effect and those winds. And I think, you know, the water was most likely being used, the demand was to put structure fires out. And that was after the fire front had already passed. So you weren't going to stop the fire front with more water, is my opinion. But again, I don't have the numbers or really the facts to be able to back that up yet.
Right. You wouldn't have stopped the fire, but afterwards, after the fire moves on and a house is burning, maybe that house, 10 houses, 30 houses, would have
stopped. That's
how,
my guess.
But explain to me, since I don't know, you put the hose in the hydrant is drawing its water from where?
Well, it depends on where it's sourced. It could be water tanks, it could be gravitational water tanks. You go into all these rural towns and they've got the big water tanks. That could
right.
be their hydrant.
But I think when we're talking about the Palisades fire, it was from what you just said.
It's from the reservoirs and the aqueducts.
And we'll be back in a minute with more of Claire Frank to talk about what could be done to stop this from happening the next time. We're back with Claire Frank, 30-year veteran fighting fires in California, author of Burnt, a memoir. You made a reference to there are chaotic people and forces of chaos. I think you're talking about arsonists. There's something of political arsonists we found in people lodging accusations here and there. And I know in a tense situation, this always happens, but the LA Fire Department Chief Kristen Cowley, she took issue with the fact that the mayor cut $18 million in the budget. So do you know from either what you're hearing from people in the LA Fire Department or knowing how these things work, could that yearly budgetary cut have affected the ability of the firefighters during this particular week?
So it might have. I'm really not like looking forward to the after action report, but I am. I geek out on this stuff. That's a great question that I have too, with like, what are the specific cuts? There's a lot of talk about, you know, they cut mechanics and then you see yards full of engines that could have been available for pre-positioning or response. But could they have? You know, was there enough staff to staff them? So it's a pretty complex. There's so many moving parts to it that you got to go down to the causal root factor, and right. I don't know. I know that it's not uncommon to have tension between the municipality's administrator, the mayor, the city manager, and a police chief or a fire chief. Just because, you know, when there's something going on in your area, from my perspective, when this is my lane, this is my wheelhouse, I know how to do this, let me command it. And when there's not smoke in the air, to not have alignment amongst the political leaders, of course there's not going to be alignment when there is smoke in the air, right? Because it brings out the best and the worst. So it's kind of sad to see it. There's a lot of chatter on it that I don't want to weigh in on it, but I think that Crowley's doing the best he can to corral what's going on in this unprecedented disaster in her city.
So as you watch from north, far north of there, are you seeing things that she's doing where you say, yeah, that's that would comport with what I would define as best practices? And are you seeing things that she's doing where you're scratching your head?
No, I'm not scratching my head. I don't. And whether it's her or any of the other leaders that are on these incidents, like, I'm not there. I'm not going to Monday morning quarterback them. And I think they probably all went in with fantastic backgrounds. Those are very hard jobs to get, you know, and you got to pay your dues. So I'm hoping the after action report says, yeah, this is what somebody not under fire, these are the decisions they would have made. But there's also always, in these circumstances, there are improvements to be made for every municipality. We have to learn from these. So that's where I get a little like, okay, we're going to get rid of the red tape. Well, you know, the red tape might help us not make these mistakes again. So those sound like platitudes that are fun to say, or not fun, but, you know, they feel pressured.
They're easy to reach for. They work for you in the moment, right? But they might not be the right way to have a correct answer. By the way, if there is a panel, a blue ribbon panel, you know, it's always red tape and blue ribbon. might you, someone like you, or you specifically serve on such a panel? Is that the sort of thing you've done?
I have not served on one, and but yeah, it would be somebody with my background would be a good choice. I know a lot of people who are still very active that are not. One of the nice things about being retired is you're not tethered to, you know, I don't have to toe the line of my particular agency. Like I'm not, right. I don't have allegiance to anything except improving the process. So that's the nice thing about using people who have left their agency behind.
I've gotten one recommendation, which is really clamp down and enforce rules on people who set fires, situations that can create sparks, not being done enough. That's one. Everything else that I've read, and I'd like you to weigh in on this, it's going to come not just at literal costs, but big trade-offs. If you build less, there is a horrible, as you know, a horrible homeless situation in Los Angeles. If you take away a bunch of homes, you're going to have to build them somewhere, and Los Angeles has shown an inability to do so. But is that what needs to be done? Because the Santa Ana winds are going to continue to blow, and the climate is not getting much cooler.
When you're fighting these mega fires, you build a box and you corral the fire in the box. And so a build idea that doesn't take away homes, but does put a different shape to the building, is build the box first and then build the homes inside of that. Instead of having these one way in, one way out roads, you have your perimeter. And you put that in place before you even put the homes in there. Because, like you said, we're not going to get to zero sparks. We're not going to get to zero ignitions. We're humans.
Oh, so it's an infrastructure solution. Build roads and highways. Okay, that comes at some cost. But if there's going to be a residential neighborhood, it can't be through some drive up a canyon.
Yeah, let's think about the box first, and then what will fit inside the box.
Okay, so a box, that makes sense. I hadn't thought of that. That is both thinking inside and outside the box. Yeah. What about the building materials of the home?
Oh, yeah. So there's no reason to not use the materials that are available that are less combustible now. Hardening the homes, closing up eaves, using a little bit more on your defensive space. But California's been cutting way back on flammables right next to the house. So they've been doing a pretty good job of that. But yeah, the home hardening construction material is just a good idea.
What about how close the houses are?
So the housing density does matter because the housing becomes fuel. But if it's, dry and dead vegetation versus a house that's been built to construction standards, I'll take the house. It's less flammable, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What about cleaning up the dry, dead vegetation?
Yeah.
Is it just, we say we could do it, but like it seems kind of practically impossible.
Well, and we put homeowners in the middle of vying agencies, right? So there's the state law says you have to clear your property of dead and dry vegetation. That's state law. But then you have maybe a coastal commission that says you can't touch anything because that's a habitat that's protected. So you can't comply with the state law. You have to violate one law or the other. So that,
interesting.
That's a problem.
But what happens after a huge calamity like this is it concentrates everyone's mind and everyone builds to not have the exact same circumstances.
Right.
So who knows? Maybe it will help with the next fire, but
maybe it will.
Some animals that rely on a habitat will suffer. Though, right, you could argue, and it would be an accurate argument, that many animals and a lot of wildlife certainly suffered because of the fires.
Correct.
Yeah. And then the last thing, and I read you wrote an op-ed on this, what politicians and everyone, just human nature says, defiantly, we're going to be survivors, we're going to, and the word they always use is rebuild. And to rebuild is to show that we aren't defeated. Is there really a way, I think you're advising that we get out of that mindset to equate success or overcoming adversity with rebuilding. Is there a way to rebuild and also greatly lessen the chance of this happening again?
So yeah, I think if you go to the box idea, that's one way to do it. If you look at the land as this is not a natural disaster. Build for the disaster that you know is coming. Fire is going to burn in those areas. It has, it will. So it's what you're suggesting is thinking about, that layer before you put the houses back in. Now, that's different than a more extreme word that is not palatable at all to probably most Americans, which is retreat. Let fire have its land back. And again, from a very macro level, that makes a lot of sense. But from the personal story level, I don't think anyone is going to. I don't think these fires caused enough damage to make that word palatable.
And finally, is there anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to say? Either maybe sometimes it's something like a misperception that you see over and over again, that when you talk to your brother, you say, oh, I wish people wouldn't think of it this way, or anything else about personal experience from your 30 years doing this that you have gleaned?
I kind of said this in the op-ed piece is, right now, this is the worst. This is the worst time ever for all of the people impacted by this directly. But again, pan the camera back, and this isn't the worst ever. This will not have more fatalities than the Camp Fire. It will not have more structures destroyed than the Camp Fire.
Right. That was 18,000 structures.
Yeah.
And now they're at like 12 something. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I loved your analysis on the one you did on climate and cost, and that was just a really sharp point to make in terms of it being really nationally a cost sharing issue because you're talking about federal funds and FEMA. And so I love that point. And I think people miss that part of it too. But again, that's a very high level, and it's hard to talk about the high level stuff just close to the incident happening. It's too soon. It's too fresh. The wounds are still there. So I would say though that it's not the worst ever. We have to brace for more. And we have to be, you know, if we can get one or two things out of each disaster to do better, then I guess that's what I'm hoping for.
Claire Frank served in the fire service for 30 years. She was Cal Fire's chief of fire protection. She is the author of Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-gee-puru-doo-puru, and thanks for listening.